How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Invasion after invasion, this means war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Sanders, a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics. She is currently working on a book, Presidents, War, and Reform, and has an analysis of Mitt Romney's foreign policy at the Cornell International Affairs Review Journal, The War Lovers Again, What the Foreign Policy Advisors of Presidential Candidates May Tell Us About Future U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Sanders.
Thank you for having me.
And you have written in your article what we should be talking about, Romney's foreign policy advisors. You've quoted President John F. Kennedy saying, domestic policy can hurt us, foreign policy can kill us. Given that there are a lot of the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq and Afghanistan wars as presidential advisors to Mitt Romney's foreign policy team, do you expect this issue to come up, foreign policy? Are they going to in any way broach it, do you think, in this convention?
I don't think they'll have a lot to say about it in the convention because economic issues, I think, seem much more promising to them. There is a considerable reluctance in the American public to get involved in another war. If you look at the deliberative polling that's been done, where they really ask people, they show them the budget, what it looks like, and so on, and say, where would you cut? There's a great sympathy for cutting the military budget. Israel is threatening to start a war with Iran and drag the U.S. into it, and that actually makes a lot of Americans very nervous. So I don't think that's going to be something that they talk about a lot. But since we've been there before, we've seen these people. This is now their third iteration. A lot of them came from the Reagan administration. Actually, a number of those neoconservatives left Reagan when he started negotiating with the Russians. They decided he was wimping out. And then they turned up again in the George W. Bush administration, and one might have thought they'd have been discredited for their disastrous war policies, but here they are again. I have to say it surprised me to see the whole gang back with Romney as his foreign policy advisors. And I think, given that we didn't recognize in 2000 that the advisors, they called themselves the Vulcans at that point, that they were going to turn American foreign policy in a much more aggressive and ambitious direction, I'm a little wary of it this time, and I think we should look at advisors. It's unfortunate that we don't.
Well, we know that John Bolton wants to be the next Secretary of State in a Romney administration, and he's apparently lobbying heavily for the job.
And if not him, his protege, who's one of the advisors.
And his protege being whom?
Oh, I've forgotten his name, I'm sorry to say. But one of his best friends and a guy who's identified as a protege of John Bolton, a younger guy, not very well known, is on the list. I think they kept off. There are a couple of people who are not on that list. Well, Dick Cheney's not on the list, but also Bolton is not listed formally as an advisor because he was a very controversial fellow. And also Elliot Abrams, who was in and out of the Reagan and George W. Bush administration, a rather controversial guy who was actually convicted of a crime and would have gone to jail had he not been pardoned by the first George Bush. So those people are advisors to Romney. He does talk to them. They talk to other people on the list. But Bolton, you know, even George W. Bush didn't have much luck getting Bolton appointed in a real position at the UN. So I wouldn't expect that to be tried again. But these are people whose voices will be heard. I think Romney is quite sympathetic to them.
So you mention in your article, Elizabeth Sanders, that one of Mitt Romney's advisors has been accused of war crimes in Lebanon, and another academic advisor has been an advocate of the El Salvador solution to insurgencies, referring back to the bloody war in El Salvador. Who are these people?
Elliot Cohen is the principal academic advisor, and he has said, I have some links to his articles in that article you're talking about, and he has said, look, you know, and people are very wary of sending a lot of troops to crush insurgencies, but we had a better way in the Reagan administration, which was just to to find a client government of conservatives and give the military a lot of money and let them put down the insurgency, and then American lives wouldn't have to be lost. I was really surprised to see him giving several speeches about that was a good idea. If you're going to have, you know, an aggressive foreign policy and try to control what goes on in other countries, and you don't want to send your own soldiers, then the obvious alternative to that is to have clients. But that worked out so badly for Latin America, if not in Latin America, and places like El Salvador and Guatemala are still trying to recover from those levels of violence that were facilitated by U.S. military aid. And the other guy is a Lebanese guy who was a Lebanese Christian who was accused of being a part of the massacre in 1982 in Lebanon and in the Palestinian refugee camps. And he also has sponsored some very controversial anti-Islamic ads, and including that training film that was shown to the New York police force. if you I'm followed
sorry,
that.
What's his name?
His name is Walid. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not looking at my article now. But it is in that article. I would recommend anybody who wants to get all the information on these advisors to follow that link in the Cornell International Affairs. And I have a list of about lots of people, 60 people. And I'm sorry that I don't have a. I could go and get a copy of it.
No. Let's continue.
Sorry.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Sanders, who is a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics. She's currently working on a book, President's War and Reform, and she has an analysis of Mitt Romney's foreign policy at the Cornell International Affairs Review Journal. The title of it is The War Lovers Again, Why the Foreign Policy Advisors of Presidential Candidates May Tell Us About Future U.S. Foreign Policy. And presumably you can pick that up online. How do you do that? Go to what, Cornell International Affairs Review Journal?
Yes, and it's all there. You great. Flip through to page 20. It flips as if you're turning the page.
The role of former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor in the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice, is fairly prominent at this convention. She's apparently being feted at many of the behind-the-scenes. She's apparently at a big fundraiser the Koch brothers held some time back. She blew everybody away.
She's an amazing woman. She's extremely intelligent and articulate. Very impressive.
But her record is a complete disaster. She was a disastrous. She was a total disaster as a national security advisor. One of the fundamental jobs of a national security advisor is to protect the president, even from himself. She ignored everything that the Clintons had told her about Al-Qaeda, and they have basically. It's amazing how she's gotten away with. And then, of course, she was one of the big promoters of the Iraq War. She was the one, after all, who talked about we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. She didn't form a natural alliance with the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. Instead, she abandoned him and didn't confront Cheney and Rumsfeld, the real powers in the Bush administration, left Colin Powell to hang out to dry, and ended up getting his job.
And it is really sad. Well, she did get his job, so there's an incentive. But had she lined up with Powell, given that she actually did have considerable influence with Bush, they were very close. She might have changed things a little. And she's very smart. She knows a lot of political science and history. And it was just very sad to see her abandon all that and not live up to the potential she had.
And as Secretary of State, she achieved zero. Can you tell me something she did? I remember she kept trying to find a peace with the Palestinians. She was the one that was blindsided by the election that brought Hamas in. It's pretty hard to believe that she's anything but...
But, you know, I suppose it's too bad she hasn't written real memoirs. But if you've noticed, in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, there were no new wars, even though there were people clamoring for a war in Iran, very strongly clamoring. Vice President Cheney and the Israelis pushing very hard. So who knows? Maybe she helped to discourage that.
Well,
and there were also resumed negotiations with North Korea. So, I mean, I have no idea whether she was behind those diplomatic initiatives, but there was a definite difference in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, I think.
Well, it's true that the Cheney and company did try to get a war with Iran going in 2007, and it was largely blocked by leaks from a woman on the National Security Council, who's now hiding out in Australia, still being hounded by the FBI. Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Sanders, a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics, and she's currently working on a book, Presidents, War, and Reform. Let's talk about some of the writing that you've done in terms of conventions themselves and how they have changed in the modern era. We, of course, as consumers of politics and as voters, are the worse for it, are we not, that both the Democrats and the Republicans now in the modern era since the 60s basically put on a PR show that's devoid of everything except photo opportunities and flags?
You know, they aren't very good for us observers anymore, but they probably still serve the purpose they were originally designed for, which is to have some unity across a party that, you know, spans a continental-sized country and that is quite regionally diverse. And the idea of bringing these people together and giving them a sense of common purpose so they go back and campaign for the ticket was always one of the big missions of the convention. And that, in a way, may be even more necessary now that these people, for the most part, are not long-term participants in politics. A lot of them are novices going to their first convention. They're not office holders. Many of them, in the old days, they were all office holders. So, you know, they had a sense of being a Republican or a Democrat. So there may be some induced unity among these people, you know, at the parties, hearing the speeches, waving the flags. But it certainly, there's no mystery anymore, and there are not going to be any fights. This is one of the most controlled conventions that I remember. So you're just not allowing any dissidents, and it's very stage managed. Of course, the Republican convention has always been somewhat more top-down control. The Democrats, you know, as a party, are just more fractious and diverse internally. So perhaps bound to give us a few fights here and there.
Well, they shut out Ron Paul. He was apparently given the option of speaking as long as Mitt Romney's people could edit his and review his speech. And he felt, I talked to his chief advisor a couple of days ago, and he said that there was no way in the world that he could sign off on the very thing we've been talking about, which is...
And it's really too bad that he didn't have a chance to put his voice out there, because he's saying things that nobody else is saying.
Well, exactly. I mean, it was because he just simply could not sign off on a neoconservative foreign policy that appears to be what's in store if Mitt Romney becomes president. But you've written that conventions used to matter much more before the era of rules reform that began in 1972. And in the 1960s, you actually had debates about party policy and directions. And it was the Democrats in 68, after that debacle in Chicago, that changed the rules in a way that have made these conventions sort of bland and predictable. Is that a correct description of what you're saying?
Sure. You said it very well. So there's just not as much interest. And yet, some people will be watching in that rather small, rarefied group of independents now who haven't taken sides between the parties. And they'll want to know what kind of people these are and whether they feel emotionally attached to them. And so maybe the speeches will tilt people over in the Romney direction who've been skeptical. I mean, that function still could be achieved. It has been at a couple of Democratic conventions, I can recall, with Clinton and Obama and so on, that they they sort of galvanized the convention and drew people to them. So there's a chance for Romney to do that, or for his wife to do it for him.
Well, her job is apparently to humanize him. And I guess to some extent reach out to the women. We do have a kind of polarized political party system in this country. The Democrats are the mommy party and the Republicans are the daddy party.
The warrior.
Yes, the authoritarian figure, as George Lakoff refers to the Republicans, and the yielding nurturing mother on the Democratic side. There are, of course, what, 10 million more women voters? So Ann Romney's got an uphill climb, hasn't she?
Well, she does. And, of course, the way our politics are stacked, we have one of the smallest percentages of women in the legislature of any democracy. It's really, really down there, 17%. I think Rwanda has twice that percentage of women in their parliament. So we don't get a lot of nurturing in our politics because women are really not there. And it's interesting the way Republican women, too, have become so stridently conservative. I heard a really interesting talk by a political scientist looking at the voting records of women in the Republican Party and how there really is no gender gap there among Republican women in the party and the legislature. They're just as conservative and more conservative, and they make very, very strong speeches to sort of prove they're one of the guys. So it takes more than just having women there if the voice is sort of snowed under.
So do you think that this election will be decided by money? I mean, that is, as a political scientist, Elizabeth Sanders, you've surely noticed that this is an extraordinary phenomenon, how much money is pouring
in.
It's
really extraordinary.
It's going to be a $6 billion election, apparently.
No, it's horrific. And, one might feel a little sorry for Obama, except that he started the whole thing when he threw aside public funding for the first time since it had existed and decided to raise his own private money. And now he realizes that the other party can be pretty good at that, too, especially with the help of the Supreme Court decision. But, one way I think it's going to make a difference, I haven't seen this film yet, and I don't particularly want to pay to see it, but the film, the movie on Obama
2016, you mean?
Right, which has a lot of money behind it, and without all the money behind it, might not be there. It's a part of the attempt to get at Obama's biggest advantage over Romney, which is personally, people like him more than they like Romney. And I think, if they can pull in independents or Democrats into those movie theaters, it could conceivably have some effect in making Obama not as likable, not as, as warm and appealing to people as he has been. So that's one way that money will help to win. The most important issue, obviously, is the economy. And that, for political scientists, that's about all you need to know. Presidents who preside over an economy growing at 3% or more always get reelected. And those who are there when the economy's not doing that well almost always get defeated. So that's that's one of the few laws of American presidential elections. And if Obama did win against that economic trend, it would be quite remarkable.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Sanders, it seems that the three factors here that could bring about a Romney victory are the suppression of votes, 5 million Democrats. We're in an era where people who want to vote Democrat are denied the vote, even if they voted before and are registered voters. They have to jump through hoops to prove who they are. Meanwhile, a handful of billionaires buying the election for the Republicans don't have to reveal who they are. They're spending record amounts of money. And then the third factor is, of course, the possibility of a little war. And that is one of the things that you've written about in your article. Your concern, and many people share this because of what the Israeli press are reporting, and that is the determination of Netanyahu and Barak to go to war against Iran. Do you think that is a wild card that could put Romney over the top?
Part of my conference paper is looking at incentives to make war, and one of the sort of reassuring things that you find in the data is that presidents almost never go to war close to their own elections because they think it would look really bad. But if he doesn't, if Israel attacks and he doesn't back it up, if it needs backing up, maybe it won't need any backing up and he can just sit back and watch. If Israel seemed to be getting pounded in retaliation and he didn't step forward, then, you know, he might be in trouble. So I'm sure it's a dilemma that he does not want to face. But Israel knows enough about American politics to know how to game it. And if they think the chances are good that he'll win, and so he'll be less reliable as an Iran war starter than Romney, which I think is the case, then they'll go ahead and call his bluff before the election. I hope they don't. But who knows? I could not predict it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Sanders.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Sanders, who's a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research interests lie in American political development and popular politics. She's currently working on a book, Presidents, War, and Reform, and she has an analysis of Mitt Romney's foreign policy at the Cornell International Affairs Review Journal, The War Lovers Again, What the Foreign Policy Advisors of Presidential Candidates May Tell Us About Future U.S. Foreign Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manos and Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Appeared by